This is Audible.
Cadman presents Tropic of Cancer by Henry Miller, performed by Campbell Scott. Copyright 1961 by Grove Press, Inc. Production copyright 2008 by HarperCollins Publishers. I am living at the Villa Borghese. There is not a crumb of dirt anywhere, nor a chair misplaced. We are all alone here, and we are dead. Last night, Boris discovered that he was lousy. I had to shave his armpits, and even then the itching did not stop. How can one get lousy in a beautiful place like this? But no matter. We might never have known each other so intimately, Boris and I, had it not been for the lice. Boris has just given me a summary of his views. He is a weather prophet. The weather will continue bad, he says. There will be more calamities, more death, more despair. Not the slightest indication of a change anywhere. The cancer of time is eating us away. Our heroes have killed themselves, or are killing themselves. The hero, then, is not time, but timelessness. We must get in step, a lockstep, toward the prison of death. There is no escape. The weather will not change. It is now the fall of my second year in Paris. I was sent here for a reason I have not yet been able to fathom. I have no money, no resources, no hopes. I am the happiest man alive. A year ago, 6 months ago, I thought that I was an artist. I no longer think about it. I am. Everything that was literature has fallen from me. There are no more books to be written. Thank God. This, then? This is not a book. This is libel, slander, defamation of character. This is not a book in the ordinary sense of the word. No, this is a prolonged insult, a gob of spit in the face of art, a kick in the pants to God, man, destiny, time, love, beauty, what you will. I am going to sing for you, a little off-key perhaps, but I will sing. I will sing while you croak. I will dance over your dirty corpse. To sing, you must first open your mouth. You must have a pair of lungs and a little knowledge of music. It is not necessary to have an accordion or a guitar. The essential thing is to want to sing. This, then, is a song. I am singing. It is to you, Tanya, that I am singing. I wish that I could sing better, more melodiously, but then perhaps you would never have consented to listen to me. You have heard the others sing, and they have left you cold. They sang too beautifully, or not beautifully enough. It is the 20-somethingth of October. I no longer keep track of the date. Would you say, my dream of the 14th November last? There are intervals, but they are between dreams, and there is no consciousness of them left. The world around me is dissolving, leaving here and there spots of time. The world is a cancer eating itself away. I am thinking that when the great silence descends upon all and everywhere, music will at last triumph. When into the womb of time everything is again withdrawn, chaos will be restored, and chaos is the score upon which reality is written. You, Tanya, are my chaos. It is why I sing. It is not even I, it is the world dying, shedding the skin of time. I am still alive, kicking in your womb, a reality to write upon. Dozing off. The physiology of love. The whale with his 6-foot penis in repose. The bat, penis libre. Animals with a bone in the penis, hence, a bone on. Happily, says Gourmand, the bony structure is lost in man. Happily? Yes, happily. Think of the human race walking around with a bone on. The kangaroo has a double penis, one for weekdays and one for holidays. Dozing. A letter from a female asking if I have found a title for my book. Title? To be sure. Lovely Lesbians. Your anecdotal life, a phrase of M. Borowski's. It is on Wednesdays that I have lunch with Borowski. His wife, who is a dried-up cow, officiates. She is studying English now. Her favorite word is filthy. You can see immediately what a pain in the ass the Borowskis are. But wait. Borowski wears corduroy suits and plays the accordion, an invincible combination, especially when you consider that he is not a bad artist. He puts on that he is a Pole, but he is not, of course. He is a Jew, Borowski, and his father was a philatelist. In fact, almost all Montparnasse is Jewish, or half-Jewish, which is worse. There's Karl and Paula, and Kronstadt and Boris, and Tanya and Sylvester, and Moldorf and Lucille. All except Fillmore. Henry Jordan Oswald turned out to be a Jew also. Louis Nichols is a Jew. Even Van Norden and Sherry are Jewish. Francis Blake is a Jew, or a Jewess. Titus is a Jew. The Jews, then, are snowing me under. I am writing this for my friend Carl, whose father is a Jew. All this is important to understand. Of them all, the loveliest Jew is Tanya, and for her sake I too would become a Jew. Why not? I already speak like a Jew, and I am as ugly as a Jew. Besides, who hates the Jews more than the Jew? Twilight hour, Indian blue, water of glass, trees glistening and liquescent. The rails fall away into the canal at Jaurès. The long caterpillar with lacquered sides dips like a roller coaster. It is not Paris. It is not Coney Island. It is a crepuscular melange of all the cities of Europe and Central America. The railroad yards below me, the tracks black, webby, not ordered by the engineer but cataclysmic in design, like those gaunt fissures in the polar ice which the camera registers in degrees of black. Food is one of the things I enjoy tremendously, and in this beautiful Villa Borghese, there is scarcely ever any evidence of food. It is positively appalling at times. I have asked Boris time and again to order bread for breakfast, but he always forgets. He goes out for breakfast, it seems. And when he comes back, he is picking his teeth, and there's a little egg hanging from his goatee. He eats in the restaurant out of consideration for me. He says it hurts to eat a big meal and have me watch him. I like Van Norden, but I do not share his opinion of himself. I do not agree, for instance, that he is a philosopher or a thinker. He is cunt-struck, that's all, and he will never be a writer. Nor will Sylvester ever be a writer, though his name blaze in 50,000 candle-power red lights. The only writers about me for whom I have any respect at present are Carl and Boris. They are possessed. They glow inwardly with a white flame. They are mad and tone-deaf. They are sufferers. Moldorf, on the other hand, who suffers too in his peculiar way, is not mad. Moldorf is word-drunk. He has no veins or blood vessels, no heart or kidneys. He is a portable trunk filled with innumerable drawers, and in the drawers are labels written out in white ink, brown ink, red ink, blue ink, vermilion, saffron, mauve, sienna, apricot, turquoise, onyx, Anjou, herring, corona, verdigris, gorgonzola. I have moved the typewriter into the next room where I can see myself in the mirror as I write. Tanya is like Irena. She expects fat letters. But there is another Tanya, a Tanya like a big seed who scatters pollen everywhere. Or let us say, a little bit of Tolstoy, a stable scene in which the fetus is dug up. Tanya is a fever, too. Les voies urinaires, Café de la Liberté, Place de Vosges, bright neckties on the Boulevard Montparnasse, dark bathrooms, Porto Sec, Abdullah cigarettes, the Adagio Sonata Pathétique, oral amplificators, anecdotal seances, burnt sienna breasts, heavy garters, what time is it? Golden pheasants stuffed with chestnuts, taffeta fingers, vaporish twilights turning to ilex, acromegaly, cancer and delirium, warm veils, poker chips, carpets of blood, and soft thighs. Tanya says, so that everyone may hear, "I love him." And while Boris scalds himself with whiskey, she says, "Sit down here." "Oh, Boris, Russia! What'll I do? I'm bursting with it." At night, when I look at Boris's goatee lying on the pillow, I get hysterical. "Oh, Tanya, where now is that warm cunt of yours? Those fat, heavy garters, those soft, bulging thighs. There is a bone in my prick 6 inches long. I will ream out every wrinkle in your cunt, Tanya, big with seed. I will send you home to your Sylvester with an ache in your belly and your womb turned inside out. Your Sylvester. Yes, he knows how to build a fire, but I know how to inflame a cunt. I shoot hot bolts into you, Tanya. I make your ovaries incandescent. Your Sylvester is a little jealous now. He feels something, does he? He feels the remnants of my big prick. I have set the shores a little wider. I have ironed out the wrinkles. After me, you can take on stallions, bulls, rams, drakes, St. Bernards. You can stuff toads, bats, lizards up your rectum. You can shit arpeggios if you like, or string a zither across your navel. I am fucking you, Tanya, so that you'll stay fucked. And if you are afraid of being fucked publicly, I will fuck you privately. I will tear off a few hairs from your cunt and paste them on Boris's chin. I will bite into your clitoris and spit out 2 franc pieces. Indigo sky swept clear of fleecy clouds, gaunt trees infinitely extended, their black boughs gesticulating like a sleepwalker. Somber spectral trees, their trunks pale as cigar ash. A silence supreme and altogether European. Shutters drawn, shops barred, a red glow here and there to mark a tryst, brusque the facades, almost forbidding, immaculate except for the splotches of shadow cast by the trees. Passing by the orangery, I am reminded of another Paris, the Paris of Mom, of Gauguin, Paris of George Moore. I think of that terrible Spaniard who was then startling the world with his acrobatic leaps from style to style. I think of Spengler and of his terrible pronunciamentos, and I wonder if style in the grand manner, is done for. I say that my mind is occupied with these thoughts, but it is not true. It is only later, after I have crossed the Seine, after I have put behind me the carnival of lights, that I allow my mind to play with these ideas. For the moment, I can think of nothing, except that I am a sentient being, stabbed by the miracle of these waters that reflect a forgotten world. All along the banks, the trees lean heavily over the tarnished mirror. When the wind rises and fills them with a rustling murmur, they will shed a few tears and shiver as the water swirls by. I am suffocated by it. No one to whom I can communicate even a fraction of my feelings. The trouble with Irena is that she has a valise instead of a cunt. She wants fat letters to shove in her valise, immense avec des choses inouïes. Lona now, she had a cunt. I know because she sent us some hairs from down below. Lona, a wild ass, snuffing pleasure out of the wind. On every high hill she played the harlot, and sometimes in telephone booths and toilets. She bought a bed for King Carol and a shaving mug with his initials on it. She lay in Tottenham Court Road with her dress pulled up and fingered herself. She used candles, Roman candles, and doorknobs, not a prick in the land big enough for her. Not one. Men went inside her and curled up. She wanted extension pricks, self-exploding rockets, hot boiling oil made of wax and creosote. She would cut off your prick and keep it inside her forever if you gave her permission. One cunt out of a million, Lona. A laboratory cunt and no litmus paper that could take her color. She was a liar, too, this Lona. She never bought a bed for her King Carol. She crowned him with a whiskey bottle, and her tongue was full of lice and tomorrows. Poor Carol. He could only curl up inside her and die. She drew a breath, and he fell out, like a dead clam. Enormous, fat letters, avec des choses inouïes. A valise without straps, a hole without a key. She had a German mouth, French ears, Russian ass, cunt international. When the flag waved, it was red all the way back to the throat. You entered on the Boulevard Jules Ferry and came out at the Porte de la Villette. You dropped your sweetbreads into the tumbrils, red tumbrils with 2 wheels, naturally. At the confluence of the Ourcq and Marne, where the water sluices through the dikes and lies like glass under the bridges, Lona is lying there now, and the canal is full of glass and splinters. The mimosas weep, and there is a wet, foggy fart on the window panes. One cunt out of a million, Lona. All cunt and a glass ass in which you could read the history of the Middle Ages. It is the caricature of a man which Muldorf first presents. Thyroid eyes, Michelin lips, voice like pea soup, Under his vest, he carries a little pear. However you look at him, it is always the same panorama. Netsuke snuffbox, ivory handle, chess piece, fan, temple motif. He has fermented so long now that he is amorphous. Yeast despoiled of its vitamins. Vase without a rubber plant. The females were sired twice in the 9th century and again during the Renaissance. He was carried through the great dispersions under yellow bellies and white. Long before the Exodus, a totter spat in his blood. His dilemma is that of the dwarf. With his pineal eye, he sees his silhouette projected on a screen of incommensurable size. His voice, synchronized to the shadow of a pinhead, intoxicates him. He hears a roar where others hear only a squeak. There is his mind. It is an amphitheater in which the actor gives a protean performance. Moldorf, multiform and unerring, goes through his roles, clown, juggler, contortionist, priest, lecher, mountebank. The amphitheater is too small. He puts dynamite to it. The audience is drugged. He scotches it. I am trying ineffectually to approach Moldorf. It is like trying to approach God, for Moldorf is God. He has never been anything else. I am merely putting down words. I have had opinions about him which I have discarded. I have had other opinions which I am revising. I have pinned him down only to find that it was not a dung beetle I had in my hands, but a dragonfly. He has offended me by his coarseness and then overwhelmed me with his delicacy. He has been voluble to the point of suffocation, then quiet as the Jordan. When I see him trotting forward to greet me, his little paws outstretched, his eyes perspiring, I feel that I'm meeting... No. This is not the way to go about it. Comme un ouf, dansant sur un jet d'eau. He has only one cane, a mediocre one. In his pocket, scraps of paper containing prescriptions for Weltschmerz. He is cured now, and the little German girl who washed his feet is breaking her heart. It is like Mr. Non-Entity toting his Gujarati dictionary everywhere. Inevitable for everyone, meaning, no doubt, indispensable. Borowski would find all this incomprehensible. Borowski has a different cane for each day in the week, and one for Easter. We have so many points in common that it is like looking at myself in a cracked mirror. I have been looking over my manuscripts, pages scrawled with revisions, pages of literature. This frightens me a little. It is so much like Moldorf. Only I am a Gentile, and Gentiles have a different way of suffering. They suffer without neuroses, and, as Sylvester says, a man who has never been afflicted with a neurosis does not know the meaning of suffering. I recall distinctly how I enjoyed my suffering. It was like taking a cub to bed with you. Once in a while he clawed you, and then you really were frightened. Ordinarily you had no fear. You could always turn him loose or chop his head off. There are people who cannot resist the desire to get into a cage with wild beasts and be mangled. They go in even without revolver or whip. Fear makes them fearless. For the Jew, the world is a cage filled with wild beasts. The door is locked and he is there without whip or revolver. His courage is so great that he does not even smell the dung in the corner. The spectators applaud, but he does not hear. The drama, he thinks, is going on inside the cage. The cage, he thinks, is the world. Standing there alone and helpless, the door locked, he finds that the lions do not understand his language. Not one lion has ever heard of Spinoza. Spinoza? Why, they can't even get their teeth into him. Give us meat, they roar, while he stands there petrified, his ideas frozen, his Weltanschauung a trapeze out of reach. A single blow of the lion's paw, and his cosmogony is smashed. The lions, too, are disappointed. They expected blood, bones, gristle, sinews. They chew and chew, but the words are chicle, and chicle is indigestible. Chicle is a base over which you sprinkle sugar, pepsin, thyme, licorice. Chicle, when it is gathered by chicleros, is okay. The chicleros came over on the ridge of a sunken continent. They brought with them an algebraic language. In the Arizona desert, they met the Mongols of the north, glazed like eggplants. Time shortly after the earth had taken its gyroscopic lean, when the Gulf Stream was parting ways with the Japanese current. In the heart of the soil they found tufa rock. They embroidered the very bowels of the earth with their language. They ate one another's entrails, and the forest closed in on them.